Okay, I think the recorder's on. That's a major thing. So I sort of feel like the prodigal son returning this morning, I guess, anyway. I'll just share a little bit of this Buddhist journey, I guess, in a little bit. But I really have been gaining so much, I think Jim implied that, I've been going to Rochester now on Sunday mornings from 8 until 9:30, so it's hard to get back here in time. It keeps me on a path, and this has been quite significant to me. So, you know sort of the, it's funny to be here in a way, kind of the depths of the loss for me last January. It's sort of this charter for compassion just happened along, and it was really literally in the valley of Phoenix, you know, to rise up from the ashes. I got this idea to start working with the charter of compassion, and I'm actually a vetted ambassador for the charter of compassion. On Wednesday, I'll be in this national, conversation of partners, and that's, I don't know for what really, what it amounts to, but anyhow, It's really was an opening for me. And I think out of that book of Karen Armstrong's The 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, you know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about that book. And to me, the biggest theme in it is sort of the Buddhist theme in it. Or at least it's the filter that I've sort of chosen to follow it with. And, you know, I think in most of my life, my approach to salvation has been, I was going to read my way to salvation, you know. So, the big life changer really for me was this summer to spend 10 days at that silent retreat. And I think it's what I experienced and what I felt way more than anything that I heard in the Dharma talks or anything. I mean, we couldn't even read there, so I didn't have anything to read for 10 days. That's the longest I've ever gone without reading, you know. So, and as we talked, and Brianna talked a little bit about self-compassion last Sunday, and about the ninth day at that 10-day retreat, I walked through this area. It's like, I called it Frog Hollow. It was kind of like going through Myrtis Slough in the Heron Rookery, but it was such a dense noise of frogs on this dirt road. And I had this revelation, I guess, about, and it just sort of overcame me to have kind of a comfort in myself, which I'd have to say that I haven't always had in my first 65 years. And so it was really that felt experience and many other things that really meant a lot. And that keeps me going on this. It keeps me going to Rochester. We'll see when the roads get slippery how committed I am. But anyhow, so this title today, it came from a title that I submitted last May. I think it was Control to Compassion, Bringing Rianne Eisler's Partnership Model to life in a compassionate community. And then I saw it in something John Collins was proposing, so I reclaimed it and altered it a little bit. And I think what I really hope today is I want to shift from Rianne Eisler's thinking, just kind of use that as and segue into our seventh principle, the interdependent, web of life, and what it's coming to mean to me and how that ties to the theme of compassion. So I hope it's meaningful for you too. Otherwise, you might say, well, I'm glad this wacky guy goes to Rochester. And I just had my eyes tested the other day, and I still have incredibly good reading vision, so you might not appreciate that in that small handout. You can take it home with your magnifier. Everything I'll say everything that's there, and you can have it for, if you like some of those quotes. And I think it's probably going to be possible that we're not going to get to them, so they'll be there for your entertainment on snowy days this winter, I guess. So, but let's start with Rianne Eisler's quote. And I don't, in the domination model, those on top strictly control those below them. People learn to obey orders without question and repress their anger against those above, leading to denial, scapegoating, and frustration taken out on those below. Everyone is guarded and mistrustful, living in fear and pain. While no one would consciously choose to live in this way, People raised in the superior, inferior model seldom realize they have a choice. They develop beliefs justifying these relationships and social structures that reinforce them, and unthinkingly pass both of them on to the next generation. Times have changed since this system was first in place, but these ingrained habits still impede the fulfilling relationships we all want. And boy, we could spend hours just unpacking all that's in that paragraph, I think. But it seems to me it raises this question. If we're conditioned to act this way unconsciously, can we really be acting from compassion from the heart? Or, Brianna used that expression last week, liberal guilt. Is our compassion really coming more out of liberal guilt sometimes, I wonder? So, more than once over this last decade, I know you've heard me talk about Model 1 and Model 2, and there's a little diagram in there. And this comes from this thinking of this organizational theorist, Chris Argyris, who's probably been working on these ideas for over 50 years. And I just come to see it more deeply and deeply. And I'd assert that this sort of the pathology that Rianne is naming creates the reality of Model 1, where we're competitive, when we want to win at all cost, where we judge ourselves favorably in relation to others, where we withhold information, where we can't be vulnerable. So we tell people to act in this Model 2, where we want to learn and find the truth and build relationships and stay open and curious. But, you know, and that's the guts. That part of these ideas are coming out of that program called Crucial Conversations. But it seems to me, at the core of the partnership model, that's at the core, that Model 2 is really at the core of the partnership model, but we haven't attended to the self issues that keep us stuck in Model 1. So, and at the core of the Charter for Compassion, you know, if you there's the charter I actually posted on there, you don't need to look at that. But the idea, for compassion to arise, the ego has to be throned. So, Brianna also last week quoted Jack Kornfield, if your compassion doesn't include yourself, it's incomplete. So, I want to, last Memorial Day, I don't know if you remember what you did, I was still reading myself to salvation back then, and I ran across this book called Self-Compassion by Christina Neff. And one of the neat things, a few times I participated in a real-time Facebook chat with her, with people in the Charter for Compassion. So, there's some quotes here that I think are significant. Self-esteem is predicated on separation and comparison, on being better than others so we're special. Now, so I think just in our society in general, when we think about self-esteem, it's sort of performance-driven, and we don't go to sort of a deeper thing that she had called sort of like self-gratitude, you know. So, the next quote, and this kind of starts getting into the notion of how all this relates to our seventh principle. We're mainly filtering our experience through ego, constantly trying to improve or maintain this high self-esteem. We're denying ourselves, though, the thing we actually want the most, to be accepted as we are, as an integral part of something much greater than our small selves, unbounded, immeasurable, and free. So when I read that quote, it just sort of tickled in me something about how does that relate to our sense of that interdependent web of being. And then that started it with me. And then back in October, this summer I went to Camp Unistar and met some nice people that are real involved with Dakota Valley UU Fellowship in Burnsville, and they asked me to talk about the Charter of Compassion back in October, and I had just run across this quote. Actually, I transcribed it from a Dharma talk. by a woman named Christina Feldman. And I think this gets us more into that kind of that interdependent web of being. The poets of emptiness really thought of emptiness not as a state, but as a way of being, and also as a doorway to compassion, an understanding with profound ethical implications. Because we were no longer locked into this view of selfing, there is no room for ill will, fear, and craving. There is no longer this closed world of I and you, us and them. Instead, there is empathy and compassion. So, I think that quote, that emptiness, kind of gets into sort of the unexpressible or the ineffable. And you know, it's hard. I think maybe to me that principle's got the kind of the analogy I've been making in my mind all my life. I've had a hard time. You know, supposedly I tried to figure this out on science misconception stuff back in the 80s about how we're so sort of see the world, we're wired into seeing the world as a Newtonian cause and effect, you know, clockwork world, but all the new science stuff is causing us to see it altogether differently. But it's hard for us to imagine this new reality. And I actually went and bought this series called The Elegant Universe, Superstring Theory, Hidden Dimensions, and Quest for the Ultimate Theory. You know, so I think that's taking us out in that physics reality. But I think there's also sort of an inner reality. And what I wanted to share is something that I actually had in a handout one time, I think last spring here, that I didn't get a chance to talk about, that I think it's helped me try to imagine what this other kind of reality that the inner being is really about. And it's interesting, we've had Vince Hatt talk to us before about the Enneagram, you know, and in this, on the handout, right in the center, this diagram, you know, it's based around a type. You know, you're the reformer, or you're the helper, or you're the achiever, or you're the individual. But there was another person, a man back in the, I think in the 50s or 60s from, and I'm not, can't remember if he was from Argentina or Chile. His name was Achazo. And he's the guy that pulled all of this kind of thinking together. And it comes out of a whole history of thinking of Aristotelian and the magic of nines and the desert fathers and how they thought about reality, and so he's calling the holy ideas, and that's those 9 points on the far right of that diagram. I sort of imagine those as beginning to be descriptors of what this interbeing reality could be like. And so in some of my obsessive time, probably a couple of years ago, I made this chart that summarizes about 40 pages in the book called Understanding the Enneagram. And what it essentially does is it takes, if you look on the columns, holy idea, virtue, passion, and ego fixation, the holy idea is what I think is that description of reality. That's when where we are in this non-fallen state. But virtues would be the qualities that we would live out. But as it works, we slip into the passions, which are really kind of like the, you know, the seven deadly sins in the Catholic Church or something like that, and these ego fixations. So all that I wanted to do this morning, and so sometime if that interests you, you might want to look at it, but just to flip to the back page a minute and stay in the first column on the left-hand side and look at E8, the holy truth. All is one. Everything is part of one unfathomable reality that collectively is truth. When Jim started off with his, you know, the principle that we're celebrating, maybe this is really the ultimate truth about this one, that we're, you know. And maybe this is our web of life. And this is the part, I mean, I think that gets me out of my head in a way, that it's non-conceptual, that we feel the truth in ourselves, and that all alienation, fear, and desire ends. So maybe that's the source of acting in a compassionate way, when we can get to kind of that place, you know. So if we look down in E9, another dimension of it, then this holy love, all one and ultimately beneficial and supportive. All is one, beneficial and supportive. And that we're all made from divine love. And that if we can relax this egoic activity, which is that Model 1 activity, and trust the being to support us. So maybe this is what we mean by trusting the process, or what we mean by faith. Up in E5, our essence experiences reality through our organism. So it's bigger than our head. You know, it's the way that we sense things. 4, under E6, they're not beliefs. They're not ideas. Rather, we recognize the actual support of presence and being, and we realize our essence. So, to me, just sort of pondering this column and then the corresponding column 1 through 4 on the other side begins to shape some kind of an image of maybe what we mean by this interdependent web of being. So, I was going to take some time, and I'm running out of time here already, and share, and I'll just comment a minute, because I think these quotes are really significant. On the back page here, on this column where it says Brother David Stendhal Rast, he's an Austrian monk. I think he's about 80 now. And he was challenged to write this book, Deeper Than Words, Living the Impossible Creed. Did I say Impossible Creed? Apostles' Creed by the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama says in the kind of on the book jacket for the book that, you know, he's really kind of the Buddhist idea of the interdependent arising is what is similar to the Christian creations. I haven't quite gotten that together, but I thought it was significant that the Dalai Lama was endorsing this book. And I think there's something there about getting to that deeperness and that inner being, and that all of these quotes kind of go back to the dominator model and how we overcome that and how compassion can flow. So what I'd maybe just close with this last quote, just last week, and I had to include it here, in the Sun magazine, the newest Sun magazine, Jacob Needleman, who's kind of a hero of mine, he's a professor emeriti from San Francisco University. He's been teaching philosophy for eons, I think. And his newest book is called What is God? And he writes that leaving the bias of the limited ego self behind opens us up to the living experience of God. Not God as a judgmental deity watching us from a throne in the sky, but God as us. It is only in and through people, inwardly developed men and women, that God can exist and act in the world of man on earth. Bluntly speaking, the proof of the existence of God is the existence of people who are inhabited by and who manifest God. God needs not just man, but awakened man in order to act as God in the human world. And without this conscious energy on the earth, it may not be possible for divine justice, mercy, or compassion to enter into the lives of human beings. So I will quit with that for today, and I hope that maybe this, you know, I put some questions up on the, and maybe some of that can fit into your conversation next Sunday. So, I just think, whatever this is, I know it's not stuff I'm going to read and learn a lot more about. It's going to be things that I'm feeling. It's going to be the ground for this compassion. So, thank you.